This is episode 36A of the Future Intelligent Leadership Podcast with guest Thomas Mengel and part of a series of special podcasts with chapter authors from the book Leadership for the Future. Welcome back to the Future Intelligent Leadership Podcast. If you're interested in innovative wisdom and practical tools for leading in a complex, uncertain, and exponentially changing world, then this podcast is for you. Aloha and welcome to this episode of the Future Intelligent Leadership Podcast. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, co-founder of Haku Global. We're an organization dedicated to helping leadership navigate a complex, uncertain, and exponentially changing world, which is driven by an emerging tech future. So if you're interested in learning about Haku Global's Future Intelligent Leadership training programs and how you can develop future intelligent leadership and scale that across your organization, then check us out at www.haku.global. Today I'm joined by Thomas Mengel. He's the editor of a new book, Leadership for the Future, which I was honored to be a co-author of a chapter in the book. And this episode is the first in a series of podcasts featuring chapter authors from the book. Thomas is a professor at Renaissance College, University of New Brunswick in Canada. Thomas has a diverse background with graduate degrees in computer science, adult education, and theology. He served in management, leadership, and consulting roles in several organizations throughout Europe. He is particularly interested in leadership and project management education in practice and theory in the context of future studies and foresight, as well as their historical development and philosophical underpinnings. He is the recent editor of this book, Leadership for the Future, Lessons from the Past, Current Approaches, and Future Insights. He's also the author of four chapters in the book, which is now available for purchase. In this book, 20 authors from around the globe present, explore, and discuss approaches to leadership from a multidisciplinary, multicultural, and planetary perspective for the 21st century. As I mentioned, you can also find a chapter in this book authored by me and Haku Global co-founder Kevin Reddy. The title is The Six Pillars of Leadership Future Intelligence. Let's listen to this episode.
Why leadership for the future? I mean, I think this is a very interesting question and a good question. And in hindsight, it always looks slightly different. Mm-hmm. But what it really grew out of was my increasing frustration with what I saw us doing in leadership education, and that is almost always looking at what the problems currently are and what the problems, the challenges were in the past, and then educating and training young emergent leaders to deal with those. It's almost like an analogy that I often use is we seem to be driving with eyes on the road at best, but mostly even with looking into the rearview mirror. And that seems to me like a good advice for people who learn how to drive, or even for teams and organizations that are delivering a routine kind of particular product or service. Mm. I do think that leadership, particularly in times of complexity and change, goes way beyond driving and managing, and it's about helping people to adapt and to adapt to ever-changing contexts. It's about motivating people to change and to move forward towards those uncertain futures. And foremost, I think about co-creating. That's what I call it: co-creating and implementing a vision that is oriented towards shared values that makes all the doing worthwhile for everyone. So, back to the analogy of the road, you can keep the eyes on the road and you can look in the rear view mirror, and that is a safe approach, but it's only half the package if you don't know where you're driving to, and if you don't know whether it's worth even driving. It might even be safer to just stop and think about it. So that's a major frustration. And the other thing is, I think if you do leadership correctly, I don't know, that's not the right word, but if you do it comprehensively, you cannot do it without looking forward, without looking into the future. Everybody, I think, agrees nowadays that leadership is about vision also. And vision is per se looking out into the future. So that's a major motivation. I was looking a couple of years ago, well, it's more than a couple of years ago, 6-7 years ago, when I started thinking about that in more earnest. I was looking at the literature, the fields, and I more than just sort of on a side way discovered the whole field of future studies and foresight. And I was thinking, why didn't I see that 40 years ago? And so that got me thinking, how can I contribute that to that? I started writing about it, publishing, I think it was 2017 the first time. And I was thinking about this book project. And so I pitched it to the publisher at the time, Leadership for the Future, because we have enough about leadership for the present and for the past. And I really wanted to make that pitch to bring those two fields together. And then the three parts that I was thinking about, and I think it worked quite well that way, is to not ignore the past. I'm an historian by training, so I would be stupid not to look at the past, not to look at the rearview mirror would be dangerous, risky, enormously risky. So looking at the past, what can we learn from the past? What can we bring into the future? And then the second big part, looking at current approaches that are somewhat, touching on future aspects and foresight aspects, looking at the what I call the value shift that happened in the field of leadership, not just there, but there as well. And then the third part, looking more seriously at what can the fields of future studies and foresight bring to the table. And what can we learn from putting those two things together, leadership and foresight / future studies. So that was sort of the big idea. And the rest almost, as they say, is history. Of course, there's a little bit of randomness there, because I reached out through various associations to look for people who would contribute. So, that's the exciting part. I had this idea, this concept, but what really came out of it was very much dependent on and relying on people to latch onto it. And I hope it worked well. I think it did.
That's great. I love that you it's just kind of that analogy you're using too. It's like you look into the future, but then you have to still allow it to emerge, right? And see what comes.
Yeah, and you and I know that, and most people who work in that field know that. It's not about, it's not sort of, the analogy might suggest that there is something like a crystal ball that you put in your car so that you have sort of your eyes out on the road right around you. You can look in the back, in the rearview mirror, and you actually see reality sort of in the past. And the analogy would just suggest that there is a little screen or crystal ball which would allow you to exactly see what comes in the future. We know that that's not the case.
Right.
What we can do, though, is understand what our impact might be on which of the futures will actually happen when we get around the corner, or when we've crossed the mountain, or whatever whatever works in that analogy.
Yeah. It's an interesting analogy too, because as you talk about it, it just also, I think about having Google Maps now, for example, and how in the, maybe in 100 years ago, or even just 50 years ago, or even less, you had the rear view mirror, and you had the road to look at, and you kind of had a, if you've driven the road before, maybe you have a map of it, or you have some future, projections of where you could go. But there was a lot of more unknowns and uncertainty in some way. And you just kind of followed, what emerged in front of you. And now we have Google Maps, and you can actually see what's a little bit ahead of you in the future, a little bit differently when you're planning things out. It doesn't always lead you though to where you want to go. Sometimes a map can be wrong still. And also it's interesting because you put a lot of, at least I do now when I drive, I put a lot of weight on that Google map. In the past, I didn't have that. I don't know if you can speak to that. What's your thoughts on
on having this Google map now.
Well, that's a good additional analogy, because yes, I do rely a lot on navigation systems, I think we all do, particularly if we drive towards the unknown. But it's not the only thing. I mean, when I take a trip over the weekend, just to use an example there, I would be stupid to just pull out Google Maps and drive right into the thunderstorm that's developing up the coast. So, yep. and Google Map doesn't tell me that. I have to have additional tools to tell me, what the weather is like. You're just using, the pandemic that we're all tired of as another example. Google Map doesn't tell me which areas in our province or in the country are to be avoided, which of them are yellow or orange. Fortunately, they are now all yellow to go green fairly soon. But these are just two examples of what we need to keep in mind and add to the mix of the potential scenarios, just to use another term of future studies, to see where do I want to go and why do I want to go? What do I expect when I go there? And so it's just a tool. And you're right, people depend on it. I think they overly depend on it. The whole technology that we have in the car, I don't have it yet, but we have the opportunity to have it, drive assist and those kind of things. The expert saying, well, you shouldn't totally depend on it unless you have a level 3 system. You should still have your hands close to the steering wheel and those kind of things. And it's a lot of it is common sense of sort of creating potential pictures of what might be out there, and then choosing the one that fits your needs and values the best.
That's great. I think it's good. A good way of thinking about it. I think it is interesting to add this Google Map layer into it, and how there is that danger too of just blindly following the technology into the future, and forgetting some of these other tools that we and resources we have as humans, and our ability to kind of shape the future. And it seems like more and more, I mean, like we're talking about, you could easily in the future, you're going to be jumping in your car, potentially it's going to take you where you want to go, and you're not going to think about that at all. And I think that's a good analogy for the dangers of where technology could lead us to.
Right. But there's additional options. While you were talking about it, that was, I think, really just a couple of years ago, I got excited by exploring the options of augmented and virtual reality. And one of my scenarios for the future of education, for example, is that we might not even have to go everywhere that we used to have to go to experience stuff. Traveling still is, and I think it cannot be totally replaced by virtual reality. I'm not saying that. But there's apps that you can now use to go into museums that during the pandemic, it was impossible to go to, or for some people, it's just out of reach in terms of the money involved. So there's all kinds of different ways of thinking outside of the box rather than hopping into the car. That's what we always did. I have friends who took their car to bring the letter to the letterbox, and I was thinking, why are you using the car? This is stupid. We've got climate change coming. At that time, nobody was talking about it, but I'm just saying we have to think outside of the box and get outside of our habits to use technology in different ways think creatively how to get what we want to get and what is important for us to achieve.
That's great. Well, let's shift and talk a little bit about the chapter that you wrote for the book. What was the title of it, and what was kind of an overview?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I wrote four. I wrote four chapters, and they kind of link together. But I'm trying to focus on the link maybe more than on the individual details. But your part of my interest in the book was that the work that I've done over the years really stretches from understanding where leadership, the field, comes from, where the theories come from, how they connect, and getting a sense of, you know, what leadership capabilities might be. And that's a focus on it of a chapter that I co-wrote with a former doctoral student of mine, whom I supervised. And that's you know, in the initial part of the book. And then in the second part, where we look at the value shift together, I would almost call that, you know, the core of my work, because it also stretches into the future studies field. And that is my passion. Yeah, I call it passion, but somebody could call it a positive obsession with values as a core part of leadership work. And I was very much impressed and informed by the work of Viktor Frankl, who many people know from his major book, Man's Search for Meaning. And the idea that you know, human motivation is very much triggered or guided by the values that we orient ourselves, our lives towards. And sort of on the side note, I was always impressed by Frankl's focus on two sort of different interpretations. He talks about values in a very pragmatic way, saying, you know, what's important to me in life now? What triggers my activity, my behavior now? But he also talks about it in the sense of the bigger value, the bigger values that guide our life in general. And what I've done over many years, even before I looked into future studies, was to try to apply Viktor Frankl's work. He was a psychiatrist, and as many know, you survived the concentration camps. And his work was mainly looking at people who were troubled by some kind of mental health issue, and what keeps them going and what could get them back out of there, and in a different kind of a setting in crises, what keeps people alive, what keeps them motivated, what makes them resilient. And I was trying to apply that concept of values and meaning to the workplace. So, you know, in my research, I looked at how does that work in a very corporate environment. What makes people sounds a bit technological, but in particular in project organizations, is it the methodology, like project management, that helps them be successful, or is it maybe more? And I wasn't surprised to find that it really the methodology is helpful, but what makes organizations thrive is the connection between individual personal values and the values that the organization is working towards. So organizations that had a very good link between what people found valuable for themselves and the organizations were doing much better, even with a tool like project management. And you know, I used that research and applied it in a bigger sense. So in my core chapter, which I call Values-Oriented Leadership, Discovering Meaning, Exploring Options, and Realizing Values, I use that research and kind of build the bridge into a bigger understanding of what would then values-oriented leadership look like. How can you apply it? What are sort of strategies that we can learn from organizations that are successful in linking personal values with organizational values, and then move forward and making something valuable? And so that's a core part. And the way I bring that into the final chapter and connect that with future studies is that I do think, coming back to what we talked about earlier, you know, looking forward, looking into the future, and trying to extend beyond the 2 to 5 year kind of horizon that we build for many organizations, looking much further. What will help us move through complexity and uncertainty is a core belief and some values, and those might shift, but at least a core belief and values that we can agree on with the people that we work together with. So, you know, I've used that in the two following chapters. One with a focus on how can we use tools of future studies or foresight, like imagination, like science fiction, to help us imagine what a future could look like. You're coming back to the analogy of earlier. Yes, we have the maps, we have the different layers of maps, we have other tools, but we still have to, as human beings, bring those things together and imagine what it would be like driving in a certain direction or arriving in a certain context. So what do I want to do there? How can I bring myself, my own values to fruition? And what would I likely be expecting when I'm there? It's kind of like, you know, another analogy that comes to mind is when astronauts are training. They're not training in conditions of the Earth that they are leaving behind. They're training knowing what they will find, zero gravity, a different kind of surface on the moon or whatever planet they are flying to. And they kind of simulate, that goes beyond, or it's a very strong way of imagination, they simulate what it will be like being there, so that they can be as best prepared as they can. And so that's what I'm trying in a chapter called From Earth to Mars and Back, Exploring Leadership Perspectives for the Future. So, you know, I'm trying to harvest science fiction as a way to get there. And in the final chapter, I'm trying to bring all of this together. And I called it Exploring Meaningful Futures Together, an integrative approach to futures and values orientation and theory and practice. So combining, you know, I'm just a couple of examples. I'm combining things like what is called the futures cone. So the idea of, you know, what different scenarios might be out there in the future. And then thinking about, based on our values, what of those scenarios might be most valuable for us to pursue, and then engage in the communication processes of getting people on board and then moving towards that. That's one, you're using the futures wheel as one of those, using gaming, using serious gaming, using augmented and virtual reality in the context of that. And what could a framework look like that helps us apply that?
That's great. I really appreciate the idea of infusing values into this leadership space in a very, you know, significant way. I mean, at least in the research we're looking at with our work too, it's values is one of the core things the brain is looking for. And I remember talking to John Sweeney, he's a futurist, and you know, he really highlights the idea that, you know, when mission and vision fail, values is what's going to keep an organization or a group of people, you know, working synergistically towards a future. And I think a lot of organizations don't understand that fully, and they rely too much on mission and vision and think that's going to be a core driver. But like you said, in complexity and uncertainty, values is what's going to really help an organization thrive and help a leadership keep his team together.
Yes. And I also think, Tyler, that values are, I don't know whether that's the right word, but the glue that can keep us together, particularly since we are developing the glue while we go. It's not that we just grab something out of the shelf and say, this is our glue, this is our values. But you know, I've always found and emphasized that it's not my values, it's not your values, it's the values of the people working together, and they have to they have to work on identifying those values and redescribing that as they go. I think that's much more productive or effective than just looking what we've done in the past, looking at a religious kind of bond that we might share, because the world is so diverse. It no longer works that way. You know, I grew up in Germany. And when I grew up, there was Catholics, there was Protestants, and there was nothing else almost. Now in Germany, it's very different. In Canada, the United States, and many areas of the world, it's very different. It's as diverse as you can find it. And so you almost have to be aware wherever you drive, you know, using that analogy again, you'll find a diverse kind of a setting. You'll find First Nation, you'll find immigrants, you'll find French-speaking, English-speaking, I'm talking about Canada here, and they all have their cultural kind of backgrounds. But when it comes to thinking, what do we as individuals or communities really value? There's more overlap than you're comparing very different kind of religious or worldview frameworks. Mm. Bringing an atheist and a believer together is almost impossible if you try to do it from their religious or non-religious belief system. But if you think about what unites us as human beings, what unites us in terms of our human passions and compassionate kind of values, it's much easier. And then you can forget about the differences and really focus on the values that bring you together. And I'm not trying to equalize everything or to kind of, you know, build another melting pot. That's not the idea, but it's really focus on something that can bring us forward.
That's great. So, you know, we've already talked a little bit about this, you know, but the book title is Leadership for the Future. And so how does your work really help to address that?
That's a good question. When you say your work, my work is manifold. So in terms of my university work right now, I do a lot of teaching and I do a lot of writing. Hmm. I hope that my writing, co-writing with the book, and you know, we talked about co-creation. This is really a result of co-creation. I hope that that book will contribute to people understanding in the field of leadership, practice and theory, understanding that we need to look forward more than we do in the past. It's frustrating to see even times of the pandemic, how much we failed having done that, arriving at a pandemic that was not totally surprising. It was out there, you know, people were talking about something like this. But anyway, it surprised us. So have we learned from the first, from the second, from the third wave? Maybe a little bit, I'm not sure, because we're still too much with the eyes on the road and in the past, as opposed to, you know, what's coming. So I hope that conversation is ongoing and will help people realize that. In terms of my teaching, I do hope that a book like this, and this is not the only one, there's more, I just started teaching, well, I'm in the third week now, started teaching a new course that I've developed called Leadership and Foresight, where I really do exactly that. And I've used a couple of chapters as readings in the book. I use other books that are out there to help students deal with this challenge of, keeping their eyes on the road and looking backwards, but also having an idea and having the tools, having some sense of what can I do to even go 10, 20 years in the future. Usually my young students, when I did tell them in the past, now let's think about where you want to be, what you think your life will be like in 10, 20 years. It was way too much out there because they didn't have the tools to do that. I do think that we now do have the tools that make it fun and exciting to playfully, you know, engage with scenarios of the future. So I hope that teaching work will do something too. And the third field that I'm exploring for myself is creative writing. And, I try to use exactly that. Imagine particular scenarios and then just write them out, you know, put images into them, around them, and see how that would work. And I'm hoping that writing also helps people to get outside of their thinking boxes.
That's great. Yeah, I think I definitely agree that more thinking about the future is important, especially in academia. I always reflect back on my educational pursuits, and you know, you spend most of your time, especially in, you know, your younger years, you know, in the U.S. from, you know, first grade to senior year in high school, and you probably spend 90% of the time reflecting on the past. Right. And there's no classes about the future. And you don't think about it. But then, I mean, as I started studying like foresight and futures, and I was realizing, what are we doing? You know, I mean, we should be spending at least a third of our time, on that, you know, or more, because, you know, you're the next generation and you need these tools to really create the future. And I think it's more urgent and important now. Maybe 100 years ago, it was less urgent because the future changed, maybe didn't change as quickly. But now it's changing so fast and people don't have the tools and skill sets to really think about it.
Right. And you know what? The other thing, Tyler, is, and part of that is a personal reflection too. When you look a couple of generations back, they didn't have to think so much about the future because they knew that there were within the community that would take care of them when the future would come and when they were no longer able to do that. Nowadays, you can't do that. Mm. I experienced my father slipping into dementia and then dying in the middle of the COVID crisis. And what wasn't planned ahead of time was almost impossible to kind of repair while you were going, because just the context wasn't there to do that. So we have to think more about the future, because there's so many unknowns that if we don't sort of at least care for the most important ones, there's not enough time when we get there to actually do something about that. So I think it also becomes more important, but we also got the tools to actually do it. So that comes together, and hopefully we can take advantage of that.
Yeah. So final question here is, what is a key takeaway you would like to leave for future leaders based on the articles or chapters in the book that you wrote?
Key takeaway. It's always difficult to sort of condense it into one sentence, but sort of in alignment and consistent with what I was saying earlier is, I think it's I think we still have to do some work to clearly bring it home that what we value as individuals and communities is at the core of what we do, at the core actually of what we've done in the past, of the core of what we do today, and it will affect the future that we will then experience, which is just one of many potential futures out there. So our values will help arrive at a future that's probably preferable to one that we just wait for if we do nothing.
Yeah, I'd like to have organizations, leaders think about, think about the future they're in, they want to be in, right? Their preferred future.
Yep.
And then what are the values that are being lived in that future? And do they align with the values they currently have, right?
Exactly. And you know, the other thing is, if you do nothing, if you just keep your eyes on the road as you go right now, or look into the rearview mirror, then probably somebody else will create the maps and will create the world that you drive in. And you don't want to do that. Or if you want to, then you have to just live with the world that others create for you. So, you know, if you want to stay active, you have to not just drive, you have to co-create the world that you're driving in.
I like that as a ending point there. So thanks, Thomas, for your time today. And thank you for all the work in creating this book and putting it together, and really appreciate your insights and your wisdom and your work.
Well, again, right back at you. Thanks, Tyler, for you and Kevin's contribution to the book, and for taking the time to engage with me and with other authors sort of in the aftermath of publishing the book together.
Thank you for joining us today on the Flowcast. To get a summary of today's dialogue, find out more about today's guests, listen to previous episodes, or discover more about Haku Global's neuroscience-based Futures Intelligent Leadership programs or customized strategic foresight and innovation sprints, visit us at www.haku.global. At Haku Global, we believe it is time for more Futures Intelligent Leadership. The future is something we need to think more intelligently and feel more deeply about, so we can collaborate to discover today's solutions for future problems. If you are in a leadership role and need support or training to scale futures intelligence
across your organization, then contact us at Haku Global. This is your host, Tyler Mongan, and until next time, have a preferred and conscious future. Aloha. Thank you.